And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Before Canadians presume moral superiority in relation to the racism of the U.S. prison system, we need to examine some astounding figures in this country. First Nations people comprise 4% of the total population, but they are 20% of the prison population. Consider the present reality of imprisoned women. 1 in 3 women in federal prisons are Aboriginal, and over the last 10 years, representation of Aboriginal women in the prison system has increased by nearly 90%. Despite representing 6% of the female youth population in Canada, 44% of the female youth in custody are Indigenous. And the current government's tough-on-crime mantra can only worsen this gross discrimination. With this in mind, we turn to the situation in the United States. Cultural anthropologist Wendy Marshall recently wrote an article titled White Supremacy and Mass Incarceration. We reached Wendy in Philadelphia to discuss the situation in the U.S. Welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, Wendy.
Thank you, Peter.
Wendy, right-wing Republicans like Newt Gingrich say there is an urgent need to address the astronomical growth in the prison population. What's the motive behind this concern among the right wing?
You know, I can't really say for sure what the motive is of the right wing, but it looks to me like it's a concern about preserving profits in the sort of prison industry. The profit margins of corporate private prison providers have been decreasing in recent years, aren't nearly as high as they were at the beginning of the whole privatization rush. So I think there's this way that, you know, people who care about the bottom line of prison industry profits are looking at the ways that they can capture profits without warehousing people in big old prisons. In some places, they're doing privatized sort of halfway houses for nonviolent offenders. But the houses are controlled by corporations that are doing it for profit.
Do they ignore the racial disparities?
I mean, if you read any of the, like, the in terms of the research I did for this piece in Al Jazeera, there's no discussion of race, of racism, of white supremacy in the consideration of why there needs to be some kind of criminal justice system reform.
Let's go back to 1987. In your article, you discuss a Supreme Court decision called McCleskey versus Kemp, and you say that decision showed just how saturated with racism the justice system is. Why do you say so?
Well, if you if you look at in the Al Jazeera article, I talk a lot about what the majority opinion was like in the McCleskey v. Kemp thing case. And although the defense had tried to present all this evidence about racial bias in sentencing and in the death penalty, the court refused to on one hand, they validated the research, but they refused to change the system or the way that things work. And basically said that if we paid attention to the way that race was played a role in sentencing, we'd have a flood of other people who wanted to talk about other disparities in terms of race or sex or of the defendants or of the attorneys or the judges or the justices in the criminal justice system. So that what Brian Stevens' analysis of the Powell decision was that it's too big to tinker with. We can't do anything about this. This is central to the way we administer justice in the United States, and there's nothing we can do about it.
So the defense actually used research to look at the racial disparity of how death sentencing was happening, and they used that in their case.
Yeah, they said that the research, which has been described as the most sophisticated study of the criminal justice system in the 20th century, found that the death sentence was applied 4.3 times more often when the murder victim was white. They pointed to all these, and they said that in an 8-year period beginning in 1972, black defendants were nearly twice as likely to be sentenced to death as white defendants. So, you know, they did a scholar did this sort of careful research identifying this kind of bias. And the court did not deny that the research was valid, but the court said basically there's nothing we can do. This opens a floodgate to other potential claims of bias, and we don't want to hear it.
And so these claims of bias, just how many people are imprisoned in the U.S., and what are the racial disparities in terms of those imprisoned?
Well, there are 2.3 million people imprisoned in the United States, and about 1 million are black. So there are just the disparities in terms of race and incarceration in the United States are huge. And by the way, I want to say that I really appreciate that you started the show talking about the kind of problems that Canada has with white supremacy and racial bias in sentencing. I really appreciate that because I was thinking about that as I, you know, as the time to do this interview approached. But there's just no question that, you know, there's tremendous, you can call it racial bias, you can also call it white supremacy, which I chose to do. So people of color are about 30% of the U.S. population, but are 60% of the imprisoned. And one in three black men will be touched by, you know, the correctional system at some time in their life. I think it's important to say, though, that it's not just black folks who are targeted, especially in terms of immigration issues. There's an explosion of Latinos in prison. And I think the same is true for white. I think in terms of the war on drugs, that there's also an explosion of white incarceration in terms of meth, you know, the sort of war on drugs and the way that meth has been played into that.
So there's an explosion of the prison population overall. It's not just a racial breakdown.
No, it's not just a racial breakdown, although in the United States, you can't talk about class without talking about race. So it's very important to notice that black communities have been targeted and devastated by the war on drugs and by mass incarceration. But that's not the end of the story. And others are caught up in the logic, because ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about social control, it's about racial control, and about the control of unemployed, formerly working class people.
What are the impacts of this mass incarceration on society after people leave prison?
Well, the impact on societies and on society and on specific communities is huge, and is completely devastating. So one thing is to sort of consider what it means for communities if a third of the men are somehow caught up in the criminal justice system. What that does to the sort of emotional and financial and cultural stability of a community where that's the case. So it's huge. There are issues about, particularly through the war on drugs, people who are convicted of drug offenses are denied access to the social welfare system, so public housing and food stamps and other forms of welfare. People who've been incarcerated have a very, very difficult time finding a job. So that communities in which there's sort of a vicious cycle, communities that are economically marginalized and people who might see the sort of drug economy as the only viable thing going on are further marginalized when they come out of prison and are not able to get even the low wage jobs that are available in communities. So the devastation is huge. I mean, one of the things I want people to be able to think about is that all this is really structural. The article I wrote for Al Jazeera had a lot of comments at the bottom of it, and I was sort of interested to see that many people wrote about how black people are just criminals, as if we are sort of inherently or essentially, you know, crime-ridden or crime-prone or something. So people need to think about it in terms of structure and in terms of how lack of access to the means to, you know, take care of yourself, to a job, drives this in very many ways, right? And that's part of why we need to look at it in a historical sense you know, and bring in questions of a legacy of white supremacy, right? A legacy of you know, black disenfranchisement and marginalization.
And I understand that in many states, when you leave prison, you no longer have the right to vote even.
That's right. In many states, that is absolutely right. That is the case. I think Brian Stevens, talking about Alabama, said that very shortly the number of blacks who are disenfranchised is approaching the number of blacks who were disenfranchised before the Voting Rights Act. So, and I think that something like 13% of black men are disenfranchised because of their previous convictions.
And so in your article, you describe this mass incarceration and the history of slavery in the U.S. What is this connection?
Well, Michelle Alexander, the author of the brilliant book, The New Jim Crow, points out that there are many blacks in prison today as were enslaved in 1850 in the United States, a decade before the Civil War. What is important to recognize is the way that a whole community is sort of taken out, removed from the scene. So, like, for example, this is sort of a little digression, but when they do unemployment and employment figures for African Americans in the U.S., they don't count the imprisoned population. So, for example, if young black men are employed at a 33% rate, that doesn't include the ones that are in prison and that are sort of taken out of the official count. So there's a legacy of structural marginalization and exclusion from sort of the main economy, which is not doing so great for anybody, that is reflected in all of these things of issues about who is worthy, who counts, and those are all things that reflect this legacy of slavery that the United States has to deal with. And then, you know, unfortunately, sort of the right wing calls for, you know, cutting costs in the prison system don't deal with these issues. You know, so that we lose the opportunity to reflect on what this all means.
Well, thank you very much, Wendy, for joining us and illuminating this for us.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been speaking with Wendy Marshall, a cultural anthropologist working on issues of race, healing, and social change.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@cooperadio.org.